The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
Welcome to the Free Library of Philadelphia. My name is Lancy Sylvia, and I'm delighted to be here representing the Raven Society, the Young Friends group of the Free Library for those in their 20s and 30s. We host special events throughout the year to build a community of young library advocates and supporters. Please go to freelibrary.org/Raven Society to learn more and to sign up. And thank you, Matt, for asking me to do this. He helps with the Raven Society. He's very nice. Now, on to tonight's event. Author of the critically acclaimed novels The Secret History, The Little Friend, and the recent bestseller The Goldfinch, Donna Tartt is a writer with a truly original voice, someone who can write about subversive bacchanals, the trappings of the Deep South, and the singular experience of youth with a depth and fluidity that calls to mind a vast ocean of both influence and talent. Her books have been translated into more than 20 languages and have sold more than 5 million copies worldwide. I first read The Secret History in high school, and in many ways it served as my version of The Catcher in the Rye. It seemed to be the right book at the right time for the right girl, and it perfectly captured a world that felt equal parts foreign and familiar. In my estimation, my humble estimation, what gives a Donna Tartt story its seductive weight is the culmination of so many tiny, perfect details, building one on top of the other, until you look at familiar things in a way you've never looked at them before. And in your mind's eye, you see, you really see, fictional people and places as if they were real. Lingering over her descriptions, my imagination ascribed a very different world to the collegian experience than the one that I would encounter several years later. Hers was mysterious and dangerous and filled with handsome men wearing very nice coats. To this day, I am upset that no one ever asks me about the screenplay I've written in my mind for this, my favorite book. Spoiler alert, young Philip Seymour Hoffman plays Henry. Tartt has created a rare treasure, a long novel that never feels long, a book worthy of our winter hibernation by the fire, says the Washington Post of her newest offering, The Goldfinch. I, for one, couldn't agree more. Ladies and gentlemen, please join me in giving a very warm welcome to Donna Tartt.
Hi, thank you. Thank you, Lancy. Can everyone hear me?
Yes, yes, yes.
I am going to read from my new novel, All You Really Need to Know About the Section I'm Going to Read From is that the narrator is a 13-year-old boy named Theo who has just lost his mother. His mother has just died in an accident, and the social workers are coming to the apartment to tell him. The social workers put me in the back seat of their compact car and drove me to a diner downtown near their work, a fake grand place glittering with beveled mirrors and cheap Chinatown chandeliers. Once we were in the booth, both of them on one side with me facing, they took clipboards and pens from their briefcases and tried to make me eat some breakfast while they sat sipping coffee and asking questions. It was still dark outside. The city was just waking up. I don't remember crying or eating either, though all these years later, I can still smell the scrambled eggs they ordered for me. The memory of that heaped plate with the steam coming off it still ties my stomach in knots. The diner was mostly empty. Sleepy busboys unpacked boxes of bagels and muffins behind the counter. A wan cluster of club kids with smudged eyeliner were huddled in a nearby booth. I remember staring over at them with a desperate, clutching attention. A sweaty boy in a Mandarin jacket, a bedraggled girl with pink streaks in her hair. And also, at an old lady in full makeup in a fur coat, much too warm for the weather, who was sitting by herself at the counter eating a slice of apple pie. The social workers, who did everything but shake me and snap their fingers in my face to get me to look at them, seemed to understand how unwilling I was to absorb what they were trying to tell me. Taking turns, they leaned across the table and repeated what I did not want to hear. My mother was dead. She had been struck in the head by flying debris. She had died instantly. They were sorry to be the ones who broke the news. It was the worst part of their job, but they really, really needed me to understand. My mother was dead, and her body was at New York Hospital. Did I understand? Yes, I said, in the long pause when I realized they were expecting me to say something. Their blunt, insistent use of the words death and dead was impossible to reconcile with their reasonable voices, their polyester business clothes, the Spanish pop music on the radio, and the peppy signs behind the counter, fresh fruit smoothie, diet delight, try our turkey hamburger. Sitting red-eyed in my shock before my rapidly cooling plate of scrambled eggs, I could scarcely grasp the more practical aspects of my situation. In light of what had happened, their questions about my father seemed so wholly beside the point that I had a hard time understanding why they kept asking so insistently about him. "So, when's the last time you saw him?" said the Korean lady, who'd asked me several times to call her by her first name. I've tried and tried to recall it, and can't. I can still see her plumpish hands folded on the table, though, and the disturbing shade of her nail polish, an ashen, silvery color, something between lavender and blue. "A guesstimate?" prompted the man Enrique. "About your dad?" "Ballpark will do," the Korean lady said. "When do you think you last saw him?" I said. It was an effort to think. "Sometime last fall?" My mother's death still seemed like a mistake that might be straightened out somehow if I pulled myself together and cooperated with these people. "October?" "September," she said gently, when I didn't respond. My head hurt so badly I felt like crying whenever I turned it, although my headache was the least of my problems. "I don't know," I said, "after school started." "September, would you say, then?" asked Enrique, glancing up as he made a note on his clipboard. He was a tough-looking guy, uneasy in his suit and tie, like a sports coach gone to fat. But his tone conveyed a reassuring sense of the 9-to-5 world. Office filing systems, industrial carpeting, business as usual in the borough of Manhattan. "No contact or communication since then?" "Who's a buddy or a close friend who might know how to reach him?" said the Korean lady, leaning forward in a motherly way. The question startled me. I didn't know of any such person. Even the suggestion that my father had close friends, much less buddies, conveyed a misunderstanding of his personality so profound, I didn't know how to respond. It was only after the plates had been taken away, in the edgy lull after the meal was finished but no one was getting up to leave, that it crashed down on me all at once where all their seemingly irrelevant questions about my father and my Decker grandparents in Maryland, I couldn't remember the town, some semi-rural subdivision behind a Home Depot, and my non-existent aunts and uncles had been so plainly leading. I was a minor child without a guardian. I was to be removed immediately from my home, or the environment, as they kept calling it. Until my father's parents were contacted, the city would be stepping in. "But what are you going to do with me?" I asked for the second time, pushing back in my chair, a crackle of panic rising in my voice. It had all seemed very informal when I'd turned off the television and left the apartment with them for a bite to eat, as they'd said. No one had said a word about removing me from my home. Enrique glanced down at his clipboard. "Well, Teo, He kept pronouncing it Teo. They both did, which was wrong. You're a minor child in need of immediate care. We're going to need to place you in some kind of emergency custody. Custody? The word made my stomach crawl. It suggested courtrooms, locked dormitories, basketball courts ringed with barbed wire fence. Well, let's say care, then. And only until your grandma and grandpa... Wait, I said, overwhelmed at exactly how fast things were spinning out of control, at the false assumptions of warmth and familiarity in the way he'd said the words grandma and grandpa. We'll just need to make some temporary arrangements until we reach them, said the Korean lady, leaning close. Her breath smelled minty, but also had the slightest underbite of garlic. We know how sad you must be, but there's nothing to worry about. Our job is just to keep you safe until we reach the people who love you and care about you, okay? It was too awful to be real. I stared at the two strange faces across the booth, sallow in the artificial lights. Even the proposition that Grandpa Decker and Dorothy were people who cared about me was absurd. But what's going to happen to me, I said. The main concern, said Enrique, is that you're in a capable foster situation for the time being, with someone that'll work hand in hand with social services to implement your care plan. Their combined efforts to soothe me, their calm voices and sympathetic, reasonable expressions, made me increasingly frantic. Stop it, I said, jerking away from the Korean lady, who had reached over across the table and was attempting to clasp my hand in a caring way. Look, Teo, let me explain something. Nobody's talking about detention or a juvenile facility. Then what? Temporary custody. All that means is we take you to a safe place with people who will act as guardians for the state. What if I don't want to go? I said, so loudly that people turned to stare. Listen, Enrique said, leaning back and signaling for more coffee. The city has certified crisis homes for youth in need. Fine places. And right now, that's just one option we're looking at. Because in a lot of cases like yours, I don't want to go to a foster home. Kid, you sure don't, the pink-haired club girl said audibly at the next table. Recently, the New York Post had been full of John Tay and Kashawn Divins, the 11-year-old twins who had been raped by their foster father and starved nearly to death up around Morningside Heights. Enrique pretended not to hear this. Look, we're here to help, he said, refolding his hands on the tabletop. And we'll also consider other alternatives if they keep you safe and address your needs. You never told me I couldn't go back to the apartment. Well, city agencies are overburdened. Sí, gracias, he said to the waiter who'd come to refill his cup. But sometimes other arrangements can be made if we get provisional approval, especially in a situation like yours. What he's saying? The Korean lady tapped her fingernail on the formica to get my attention. It's not set in stone that you go into the system if there's somebody who can come stay with you for a little while, or vice versa. A little while, I repeated. It was the only part of the sentence that had sunk in. Like, maybe there's somebody we could call that you might be comfortable staying with for a day or two? Like a teacher, maybe, or a family friend. Off the top of my head, I gave them the telephone number of my old friend Andy Barber, the first number that came to me, maybe because it was the first phone number beside my own I'd learned by heart. Though Andy and I had been good friends in elementary school, movies, sleepovers, summer classes in Central Park, in map and compass skills, I'm still not quite sure why his name was the first to fall out of my mouth, since we weren't such good friends anymore. We'd drifted apart at the start of junior high. I'd hardly seen him in months. Barber with a U, said Enrique as he wrote the name down. Who are these people? Friends? Yes, I replied. I'd known them all my life, practically. The Barbers lived on Park Avenue. Andy had been my best friend since third grade. His dad has a big job on Wall Street, I said. And then I shut up. It had just occurred to me that Andy's dad had spent some unknown amount of time in a Connecticut mental hospital for exhaustion. What about the mother? She and my mom are good friends. Almost true, but not quite. Though they were on perfectly friendly terms, my mother wasn't nearly rich or connected enough for a social pages lady like Mrs. Barber. No, I mean, what does she do for a living? Charity work, I said after a disoriented pause, like the antique show at the armory. So she's a stay-at-home mom. I nodded, glad she'd supplied the phrase so handily, which, though technically true, was not how anyone who knew Mrs. Barber would ever think to describe her. Enrique signed his name with a flourish. We'll look into it. Can't promise anything, he said, clicking his pen and sticking it back in his pocket. We can certainly drop you over with these folks for the next few hours, though, if they're who you want to be with. He slid out of the booth and walked outside. Through the front window, I could see him walking back and forth on the sidewalk, talking on the phone with a finger in one ear. Then he dialed another number for a much shorter call. There was a quick stop at the apartment, less than 5 minutes, just long enough for me to grab my school bag and a few impulsive and ill-considered articles of clothing, and then back in their car again, in the back seat. Are you buckled up back there? I leaned with my cheek to the cold glass and watched the lights go green all up the empty Don Canyon of Park Avenue. Andy lived in the upper 60s, in one of the great old white glove buildings on Park, where the lobby was straight from a Dick Powell movie, and the doormen were still mostly Irish. They'd all been there forever, and as it happened, I remembered the guy who met us at the door, Kenneth, the Midnight Man. He was younger than most of the other doormen, dead pale and poorly shaven, often a bit slow on the draw from working nights. Though he was a likable guy, had sometimes mended soccer balls for Andy and me, and dispensed friendly advice on how to deal with bullies at school, he was known around the building for having a bit of a drinking problem. And as he stepped aside to usher us in through the grand doors and gave me the first of the many, "God, kid, I'm so sorry," looks I would be receiving over the next months, I smelled the sourness of beer and sleep on him. "They're expecting you," he said to the social workers. "Go on up." It was Mr. Barber who opened the door, first a crack, then all the way. "Morning, morning," he said, stepping back. Mr. Barber was a tiny bit strange-looking, with something pale and silvery about him, as if his treatments in the Connecticut ding farm, as he called it, had rendered him incandescent. His eyes were a queer, unstable gray, and his hair was pure white, which made him seem older than he was until you noticed that his face was young and pink, boyish even. His ruddy cheeks and his long, old-fashioned nose, in combination with the prematurely white hair, gave him the amiable look of a lesser founding father, some minor member of the Continental Congress teleported to the 21st century. He was wearing what appeared to be yesterday's office clothes, a rumpled dress shirt, and expensive-looking suit trousers that looked like he had just grabbed them off the bedroom floor. "Come on in," he said briskly, rubbing his eyes with his fist. "Hello there, dear," he said to me. The dear, startling from him, even in my disoriented state. Barefoot, he padded ahead of us through the marble foyer. Beyond, in the richly decorated living room, all glazed chintz and Chinese jars, it felt less like morning than midnight. Silk-shaded lamps burning low, big dark paintings of naval battles and drapes drawn against the sun. There, by the baby grand, and a flower arrangement the size of a packing case, stood Mrs. Barber in a floor-sweeping housecoat, pouring coffee into cups on a silver tray. As she turned to greet us, I could feel the social workers taking in the apartment and her. Mrs. Barber was from a society family with an old Dutch name, so cool and blonde and monotone that sometimes she seemed partially drained of blood. She was a masterpiece of composure. Nothing ever ruffled her or made her upset. And though she was not beautiful, her calmness had the magnetic pull of beauty, a stillness so powerful that the molecules realigned themselves around her when she came into a room. Like a fashion drawing come to life, she turned heads wherever she went, gliding along obliviously without appearing to notice the turbulence she created in her wake. Her eyes were spaced far apart. Her ears were small, high set, and very close to her head, and her body was long-waisted and thin, like an elegant weasel's. Andy had these features as well, but in ungainly proportions, without her slinky ermine grace. In the past, her reserve, or coldness, depending on how you saw it, had sometimes made me uncomfortable, but that morning I was grateful for her sang-froid. "Hi there. We'll be putting you in the room with Andy," she said to me without beating around the bush. "I'm afraid he's not up for school yet, though. If you'd like to lie down for a while, you're perfectly welcome to go to Platt's room." Platt was Andy's older brother, away at school. "You know where it is, of course." I said that I did. "Are you hungry?" "No." "Well then, tell us what we can do for you." I was aware of them all looking at me. My headache was bigger than anything else in the room. In the bull's-eye mirror above Mrs. Barber's head, I could see the whole scene replicated in freakish miniature. Chinese jars, coffee tray, awkward-looking social workers and all. In the end, it was Mr. Barber who broke the spell. "Come along, then. Let's get you squared away," he said, clapping his hand on my shoulder and firmly steering me out of the room. "No, back here, this way, aft, aft, right back here." The only time I'd ever set foot in Platt's room, several years before, Platt, who was a champion lacrosse player and a bit of a psychopath, had threatened to beat the ever-living crap out of Andy and me. When he'd lived at home, he'd stayed in there all the time with the door locked, and, Andy told me, smoked pot. Now all his posters were gone, and the room was very clean and empty-looking since he was away at Groton. There were free weights, stacks of old National Geographics, an empty aquarium. Mr. Barber, opening and closing drawers, was babbling a bit. "Let's see what's in here, shall we? Bedsheets and more bedsheets. I'm afraid I never come in here. I do hope you'll forgive me. Swimming trunks. Won't be needing those this morning, will we?" Scrabbling around in yet a third drawer, he finally produced some new pajamas with the tags still on. Ugly as hell. Reindeer on electric blue flannel. No mystery why they'd never been worn. "Well then," he said, running a hand through his hair and cutting his eyes anxiously toward the door. "I'll leave you now. Hell of a thing that's happened, good Lord. You must be feeling awfully rough. A good solid sleep will be the best thing in the world for you." "Are you tired?" he said, looking at me closely. Was I? I was wide awake, and yet part of me was so glassed off and numb, I was practically in a coma. "If you'd rather have company, perhaps if I build a fire in the other room, tell me what you want." At this question, I felt a sharp rush of despair. For as bad as I felt, there was nothing he could do for me. And from his face, I realized he knew that too. "We're only in the next room if you need us. That is to say, I'll be leaving soon for work, but someone will be here." His pale gaze darted around the room and then returned to me. "Perhaps it's incorrect of me, but in the circumstances, I wouldn't see the harm in pouring you what my father used to call a minor nip. If you should happen to want such a thing. Which, of course, you don't," he added hastily, noting my confusion. "Quite unsuitable. Never mind." He stepped closer, and for an uncomfortable moment, I thought he might touch me or hug me. But instead, he clapped his hands and rubbed them together. "In any case, we're perfectly happy to have you, and I hope you'll make yourself as comfortable as you can. You'll speak right up if you need anything, won't you? He had hardly stepped out when there was whispering outside the door. Then a knock. "Someone here to see you," Mrs. Barber said, and withdrew. And in plodded Andy, blinking, fumbling with his glasses. It was clear that they had woken him up and hauled him out of bed. With a noisy creak of bed springs, he sat beside me on the edge of Platt's bed, looking not at me, but at the wall opposite. He cleared his throat, pushed his glasses up on the bridge of his nose. There followed a long silence. Urgently, the radiator clanked and hissed. Both his parents had gotten out of there so fast, it was like they'd heard the fire alarm. "Wow," he said, after some moments, in his eerie, flat voice. "Disturbing." "Yeah," I said. And together we sat in silence, side by side, staring at the dark green walls of Platt's room and the taped squares where his posters had once been. What else was there to say? Thank you. And now, if anyone in the audience has any questions, now's the time.
Well, I said, why does it take you so long to write a book?
This is a long book. It's very long. It's, in a way, I mean, this is, if I do my math right, this would be three 250-page books. I could, if I divided it up differently, it's funny because when I first started writing, I started out writing, as most student writers do, I started out as a poet, but I could never get to the level that I wanted to be. And then I started writing short stories because that's what students do. But it wasn't really until I began writing my first novel that I understood that I had found what I did best, what I like to do. And the long-form novel is really just what suits me best. I love spending time with the characters and getting to know them in a really deep way over a decade. It's a very different kind of a novel if you spend as long on a novel as I do. The 10 years that I spent, the character, it takes place over that amount of time for the character too, and there's a sort of depth as an artist with the material that you can achieve by spending so long with the same characters that to me is much more enjoyable, a more enjoyable way to work. If I'm going on vacation, I'm the person who likes to go one place for a month and stay in that one place and get to know it really well, rather than sort of hopping around to lots of different places. I want to know one thing very deeply, and that is it's just where my attention goes and my habits of working. But Melville talked about the process of writing a long novel, and he compared it to a dive. He compared it to a whale's dive, you know, like 12 miles beneath the surface, you know, and you're down there for a really, really long time. And he said, you know, any fish can swim in the shallows, but it takes a great whale to go down, you know, 12 miles downstairs and attain the very, very bottom. And that is really... it's a lot of work, and it takes a lot of time to really get down to that, you know, downstairs to really the bottom of the ocean floor. That's what interests me, and that's always where I'm going to want to go. And yeah, long journeys. Yes.
I don't mean to sound sexist, but of your three novels, why did you choose to have two of the protagonists male? And by the way, you do it brilliantly, but it just seemed like an unusual choice.
Well, you know, that's what the first editor who read The Secret History thought as well. He read it and told me that that advised me immediately to change the point of view to a woman's point of view, because no successful novel had ever been written by a woman from the point of view of a man. This was advice I'm glad that I didn't take. The type of story, it's a technical question at bottom, because the kind of story I was trying to tell with The Secret History would not have worked with a girl, because there couldn't be any question at all that she was attracted to any of the boys. He had to be drawn in on a completely different level. It wouldn't have worked with a girl narrator. And I was just well into telling the story by the time it was impossible. It would have been a different novel. It would not have been the one I wanted to write. And with this one too, with the relationship of Theo and Boris, who is a character who is very important later in the novel, it wouldn't have worked if Theo had been a girl, because then there would have always been the question. You're setting it's just about fictional conventions, certain kind of expectations that are set up when you have. It would have been. It wasn't the story that I wanted to write, but the fun thing about being a novelist is not being yourself. That's the great thing. You're someone else, and you're someone else for a long time. It's an alternate life. It's so, in a way, I love that distance, and it's wonderful to be someone else and to try to be someone else for a long time, and to write in someone else's voice. When I was writing the notes for this novel, actually, I often took the notes in character as Theo. I mean, I can tell the ones that I'm taking as, because I would see something and remark on it, you know, make a note of it. Not necessarily what I would think, but what Theo would think. So it was something that I enjoyed writing from a male point of view. And it's something that, for whatever reason, I can't explain why, it always came easily to me. Yes?
I hear such reverberations in your work of great male authors like Salinger and Cheever, but I wondered who your female masters were that you aspire to. Or...
I really, really, really love Joan Didion. Really love Joan Didion. You know, first, last, and center. I am crazy about Joan Didion. She's you know, for my money, one of the great living American writers. I love Ivy Compton Burnett, actually. Really love Ivy Compton Burnett. I love Nancy Mitford. I love Rebecca West. I love Mary Shelley. I love Frankenstein. And I like Jane Austen on a line-to-line level. Jane Austen is wicked. Her observations are so wicked. She's an amazing, devastating judge of character. She's so wonderful. But though I love her incidentally on a line-to-line level, and I love the way that she creates character, her novels are just a bit too claustrophobic and circumscribed for me. It's the plots that bother me, because you always know where you're going to end up, and it actually makes me a bit sad, because you always know that you don't have any option except to marry Mr. Darcy. You don't have another choice. You're not going to, you know, go away to sea on a pirate ship or whatever. But yes, as a technician, purely as a technician, she's as great a writer as any writer of the 19th century. And you know, I really love Emily Dickinson too. She was amazing. She was a wonderful poet. Just the sort of ferocity of her vision just tending on such a tiny, tiny, tiny point. It's the claustrophobia of Austin times 500, but yet it's so claustrophobic it just kind of blooms and explodes into something else. It becomes total freedom. And it's just magnificent. I mean, she's as wild as Hart Crane or any rambling poet, anyone who had the freedom to, you know, put their hands in their pockets and go anywhere they wanted. But I really love Emily too.
Well, that's cool to hear you say about a boy's voice. I just read The Roundhouse by Louise Erdrich, and her possession of that young boy's voice is similarly masterful as yours. So I really appreciate that. Thank you.
Thank you. Yes? Actually, I was thinking about you, but then the next one, the yes.
No rush.
Sorry.
I guess that my question is regarding the settings of your novels. Secret History and Little Friend were respectively about a very insular New England college town and a rural South, and The Goldfinch, I'm not very deeply into it yet, but it's a very urban novel. Was there anything that inspired that sort of change, and how was it writing such like a city-based novel?
It was great because I enjoyed the loneliness of writing about a city. The urban landscape is kind of a lonely landscape, and it's very different from the sort of claustrophobic atmosphere of a college where they always, in the secret history, they always are feeling that someone's looking right over their shoulder, which indeed they are. And the same thing with the small town and the little friend. I mean, this very sort of small, circumscribed family world. And I've lived in New York longer than I've lived in Mississippi now, so New York's a city that I know very well, and Amsterdam's a city that I know fairly well, too. I've spent a good deal of time in Amsterdam. It's the European city beside Paris that I've spent the most time in, and I really... And to me, those two cities seemed connected. I mean, there was a dark mood that connected both of them. I mean, that really had to do with art, that had to do with art and money and the movement of money. And I think the reason that I loved Amsterdam so much the first time that I went there is because there are things that do remind you of New York, that reminded me of Manhattan. You know, there are many Dutch street names in Manhattan still, and but the experience of writing about a city is somewhat different because my first two novels took place in imaginary towns that were not a million miles away from Alexandria, Mississippi, not a million miles away from the town where I grew up, nor was Hampton College a million miles away from Bennington College, but they were made up places. And the streets had different names, and I was able, and that's very convenient as a fiction writer because you can have someone get somewhere that takes them 5 minutes to get and 20 minutes if they need to get there. Geography comes in very, it's very convenient to be able to change geography to suit you, which I was able to do in my first two novels. This, I really did have to think about actual street names, actual places in New York, and I'm sure I'll be getting letters for the next 35 years, you know, telling me that, you know, 75th Street runs east instead of west, or what, you know, I don't know, just, but, so there's a lot, when you write about real places, there's a element of copy editing I was letting myself in for that I didn't really, I wasn't that crazy, but you know, New York is New York, you can't make up that city, it is what it is.
You started to touch on the question that I had. So I was curious, you seem to be kind of guarded about your personal life, and you mentioned the settings for your books, which seem to reflect where you've lived, and I was wondering what from your life you put into your books, where you see yourself reflected in your characters and in your stories. And a second question to that is, how soon after Bennington did you write The Secret History?
I started writing The Secret History while I was at Bennington. I started writing it when I was 19 years old. And I was in a writing tutorial with Brett Easton Ellis. Brett Ellis and I were the only two students in it. And he was writing what would become Less Than Zero, and I was writing what became The Secret History. It just took me a lot longer to finish my book. Because of my working habits. But my first book is dedicated to Brett Ellis. We started writing it at school, but for me, I continued writing it after I left school, and I think it was a stronger novel because a lot of The Secret History is about missing school. I was in New York then, and really yearning for college and wanting to be back there and wanting that landscape and the cold and the birch forests and snow and it was about wanting to recreate that in some way. So I think it was a much stronger novel there was a quality of yearning in it in some way. And as for the first part of your question, what part of myself do I see in my books? That's hard for anyone to say. It's everything that any artist does is a self-portrait to some degree. Everything. But part of being an artist is being kind of unself-conscious about that and not really examining it too closely. It sort of goes right at the root of cuts at the root of what I do. It's, if you work from the unconscious, it's better not to probe around too deeply in that. It's a black box. I let it do what it does. It sends things up. The reason that I write fiction instead of nonfiction is that that's the way that I process things. They come out through story. If I thought about them in a more blatantly autobiographical way, I'd be a really different writer. I'd be writing different work, different kind of work. Question over here?
I was just curious about your writing habits and any tips you give to aspiring writers about writing habits when you write a novel.
The main tip that I can give you about writing habits is to do it every day. My teacher Barry Hanna told me to do, and it's you should write something every day. Even if much of the writing that I do is not intended to be in a novel, and it's never going to end up in any kind of finished work. I keep notebooks in the same sense that an artist would keep a sketchbook. You know, you flip through an artist's sketchbooks, and you see hands, you see faces, you see branches of trees, you see isolated flowers, you see things that are disjointed from each other that aren't part of a composition. And that's how I work. I mean, I'll go back through my notebooks and find things and pull them, and they'll become sometimes part of a finished composition, and sometimes they won't. You know, I had written a lot of the Amsterdam portion of this book 20 years ago, and it just didn't... I had just written it while I was in Amsterdam. I had written the descriptions of the streets and the way that it felt to be there, that sort of gloomy brown, sort of olive green water of the canal and really low-hanging skies and kind of just the feel of the town. Wrote about it a lot. I have similar notebooks I kept when I was in Sweden, when I was in France, when I was in Japan. Those haven't found their way into a novel, and they may never. For me, a lot of writing is to write without necessarily thinking so much what's going to go into a finished book. It's sort of trusting that things will sort of magnetically find each other. Once you find your way into a story, things will sort of fly in from sources that you're not expecting. But the discipline of writing every day is very important. And, you know, it's not as if, I always tell students this all the time, it's not as if I sit down. Somebody asked me the other day in an interview, how did you feel when you typed the last word of your novel? And that's just not the experience of it at all. That's not how it is. I wrote a lot of the end before I wrote the beginning. I have a quote on the wall of my office. Paul Valray, disorder is the precondition of the mind's fertility. And it's a very important thing to remember. I mean, I remember reading an interview with the painter John Curran years ago in The New Yorker, and he said one of the things about being a painter that you really have to get used to is that for a long time while you're working on a painting, the painting is going to look bad, you know? It's not going to look good. And to not think it has to be perfect, you know, the second that you do it. But I'm a firm believer in if you spend the time at your desk every day, and for me it's the morning. I go in the morning, but for other people it's different times. If I'm having a good day, I'll stay and I'll work. If I'm not, I'll get up and go do something else. But, you know, it's about finding the time of day that works for you. I mean, some people are more awake in the afternoon. Some people like to write at night. Sometimes I write at night, but it depends on how I feel during the day. But it's about finding the time that's right for you and really committing to it and really making that serious, and you know, not, and that time is sacrosanct. And even if you just sit there for 3 hours, go and sit there for 3 hours, even if you can't think of a single thing to say. And something about the act of just going and sitting there and being there will make it start to happen. Yes.
I have two questions for you. First of all, since it does take you so long to write the books, is it hard to let go of the characters once it's over?
Yes. Yes. Yes.
All right, then question two. none of your books have been made into screenplays. I remember when Secret History came out, there was all sorts of hullabaloo. And
well, they have been made into screenplays. They just haven't been made into films.
There you go. Yeah. Would you ever consider writing the screenplay for it, or would you trust it in someone else's hands?
No. Okay. No. I've got no real interest in seeing any film adaptations of my work. You know, it's a different... to convert a book into a movie is a difficult thing. But my books are so internal; they are from such they're so interior, and I'm usually not happy with films that I see of books that I really love. And, you know, I think that there are many books that have lasted a lot longer and are much stronger for not having faces attached to them. I had a friend who told me about the first time his kid saw the Harry Potter movies. And, you know, she started crying. She's like, that's not what Hermione looks like. You know, and I remember Nora Ephron actually years ago telling me about she had read the Oz books before she went to see the Judy Garland movie of The Wizard of Oz, and how upset she was. You know, this wasn't her Oz, but then you know it sort of takes over, and now that is, you know, now the cinematic version sort of, and for a writer that's a little bit of a frightening. You know, it's a frightening thing to know that something completely outside your control will come in and influence what you've written forever. So it's not, it's not anything that I'm, you know, particularly interested in. Yes?
I'm curious as to your process. Do you think and know the end of what you're attempting to have the characters develop and then go back and fill in the details, as it were? Or are you simply writing and developing a story, you don't know where it's going to end when you start?
Both. When this is an analogy that I think E.L. Doctorow made it, but it struck me as completely apt. He said that writing a novel is like driving across country. And you may start out in Los Angeles, you know you're going to end up in New York, but so you have a general plan, but if you see something interesting off the highway, you have to leave yourself open for surprise along the way, because surprise, you know, it's a real axiom, no surprise for the writer, no surprise for the reader. So I have a general map, I have a general plan, and sometimes, you know, I'll make a detour, I'll get lost, I realize I shouldn't have really gone this way, but I always have the plan, I can get back, I know the general direction where I'm going always. But then the wonderful thing about writing a long novel especially is that sometimes you're 3, 4, 5, 6 years into it, and that's when you see something that you never saw before, something you never saw coming. And when you see that, you know that the reader won't see it either. You know, when you who know the material so well are surprised by it. So, and it's a delicate balance, trying to stay open at the same time as, but the most important thing is to really be alert to possibility, the same way when you're driving and you'll see something interesting, an interesting detour that you can take, and you may end up in some wonderful little town that's going to be the highlight of your trip, but you're still going to end up in New York. So, yes?
I saw recently in the New York Times article that your novel was associated or referred to as a Dickensian novel, and I was wondering if Dickens had any influence in your writing and all. And also, as a high school teacher, do you have any advice in terms of teaching novels still like Dickens or going with more contemporary for students today?
Well, for me, I read Dickens very young, and I was completely mesmerized by him because a novel like Oliver Twist, that was the first one I read, is very unsanitized. I mean, it's very politically incorrect. Horrible things happen in it. Oliver's incredibly endangered. The great thing about classics is they are shocking and startling if we let them be. They always have something new to tell us. That's why they're classics. There's some element of the unpredictable and of the strange about them. But I don't know. I mean, Dickens is so... I think children... every child I know is interested in A Christmas Carol, I mean, for instance, which is Dickens. And Dickens's plots are like that. I mean, just the plot themselves, even if you're not particularly interested in the language or the social implications or whatever, or the plots are so strong. I mean, in a novel like Great Expectations, it really is pretty riveting. So I don't know. I think that, you know, for children with Dickens, I mean, I think those are good ones to start out with. I think an attentive child, and not every book is going to affect a child the same way. Some children are, you know, you're throwing a handful of seeds out on the ground. Some of them are going to catch, some of them won't, you know. But yeah, for many generations, I mean, Great Expectations was read in American high schools. And Miss Havisham really is a deeply ingrained part of sort of the psyche. I mean, we recognize her when we see her. Ebenezer Scrooge, I mean, they're so archetypal that I think children respond to them really very well. Those would be the ones that, and then you can't make them do it. I mean, there was a piano in my house and I had absolutely no interest in it. I had lessons. My mother, I couldn't have cared less. Everything was done to push me in the direction of the piano and I cared not for the piano at all. So you can't make a kid, you're never going to teach a class where every kid is, oh my God, I'm so excited, I'm going to become a Dickens scholar. I mean, it's, you know, you're, but, you know, maybe, you know, some night, you know, some, you know, man in his 40s will be, you know, having his whiskey by the Christmas tree and sort of thinking about his life and a little bit thinking about Ebenezer Scrooge, or maybe thinking about, you know, sort of the missed chances of Pip, about, you know, of you know, relative spurned on the way up, or, you know, those lessons stay. I mean, the thing about books and what separates books really from any other art form is that they really do change us. When we read a book, that's why books are thought to be dangerous. I mean, because they are dangerous. If we read a book, and it doesn't even have to be a good book, it doesn't have to be a great book, it doesn't have to be a masterpiece, it can be a bad book, it can be a comic book, but if a book really affects us, and it changes the way that we see things and feel, we put it down and we're a different person, we're transformed from the inside. And that's what books do, and no other art form does that in precisely the same way. Moral problems are played out in the field of time in a novel so that you can see really very difficult moral problems played out in full over the span of a life that you in the movies we're voyeurs, we're looking on from the outside always. But in a book, you're in somebody's soul. You know what it's like to be somebody else. And that's an experience that not everyone is always going to, but some people are always going to want that. That's the thing that only books can give. And the people whose temperament it is to want that are always going to want it. And there's nothing else that will give it to them. One more question I'll take. Yes.
I was just wondering, like, what fascinates you most about taking the perspective of children? I'm very interested, especially in the characters that you, like, in The Little Friend and in The Goldfinch.
Well, with children, the interesting thing is their views aren't really yet formed, and they're figuring out the world at the same time that... that the reader knows a little more about the world presumably than the child does, but it's very interesting to see how the child is navigating his way in the world, how the child's values come into contact with his environment. But for me, I love writing about children because the books I loved when I was, for me, that's a way back into sort of the readerly fun of. When I was a child, I would just read and just gallop through books, and I would hardly be able to look up. And just reading about, and it was children's books mostly that they had a great immersive sense of reading, where you just are inside the book, where you're living it from the inside. And so, in writing about children and young people, that for me is a way back to that sort of primal excitement of childhood reading. It's really hard for me to get to find that sort of immersive experience in a book that is. It happens, you know. I'm thinking about. I mean, a book like Yasunari Kawabata's Snow Country, beautiful, elegant, perfect little novel. But it's not a book that you admire it, and it's gorgeous, but it's not a book you stay up all night reading, and it's not a book that you misplace and think, oh my God, what did I do with my book? What did I do with my book? You know, and you know, children's books were the first books that gave me that feeling. And so writing about children is a way as an adult to recapture that kind of fun of reading. So, anyway, thank you all for coming. I'm a great audience. So,
thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.